generally.
This is the Jake Sun interview on June 21st, 2010.
So, Mr. Sun, thank you for taking the time to talk to us. It is June 21st, 2010 at 4 p.m. East Coast time. My name is Chris Seifer. With me is Dixie Noonan and Donna Norman, who I don't think I mentioned earlier. Mr. Sun, we are with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We were established by a statute passed last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act 2009. It tells us to figure out the causes of the financial crisis. That statute tells us to look at institutions that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of government assistance, and that's why we're looking at AIG. It tells us to look at the role of complex derivatives in the financial crisis. That's another reason we're looking at AIG. And that's one of the reasons we've asked to talk to you. And like I said, again, thank you for taking the time to talk to us. Before we get started into the substance of my questions, can you just give me a brief summary of your educational and work background since college?
Sure. I went to school. I graduated Princeton. Do you need a year also?
Or, sure.
Okay, give me a year. Okay, sure. I graduated Princeton in 1982 with a Bachelor of Science in Chemical Engineering. I then subsequently got a Master's degree in Chemical Engineering in Princeton and worked for a few years as a chemical engineer in Intel. Then I attended Columbia University Law School, graduated in 1990. I spent 1 year clerking for Judge Milton Pollack in the Southern District of New York. And then went to Cleary Gottlieb, worked there for 7 years in both their New York and London offices. Then subsequently I answered a call by a recruiter to join AIG SP in its London office, which I joined in March of 1999. I've been at AIG SP and its subsidiaries over 11 years now. I was in London for 4 years, and I subsequently transferred in September of 2003 to Wilton, and I've been at Wilton ever since then.
Okay, thank you. So if you could just then give me a general description of your job responsibilities at AIG FP, and if they changed, tell me how they changed.
Yeah, they changed significantly. When I first came on board in 1999, I was the only lawyer in London handling basically everything there, which was primarily swaps. It's the documentation, things of that nature, and the vast gamut, even including things as basic as cleaning contracts and whatnot. But I was the only lawyer there. Subsequently, about a year later, another lawyer joined me. The two of us were the two lawyers in London which handled all the transactions out of London. He was the more senior lawyer, so he did primarily the structured transactions. I did more what they call the flow work, which was derivatives, interest rate swaps, equity derivatives, structured notes. And a few structured transactions, which were the structured leasing transactions. Structured mortgage transactions, but primarily from the interest rate side. Subsequently, I transferred to the Wilton office to take over from a person who had decided to pursue other opportunities. His name is Mike Southwick. He was in charge with a number of areas which I took over, includes the structured leasing world, includes structured finance such as CDOs, includes the benefit responsive option deals, which is BROs, which I'm not sure whether you know the acronym, but basically it's a wrap of obligations would be part of a stable value fund for pension and 401ks. Then I also, if I didn't mention, for structured leasing, which is at one point very, very important for financing for municipal entities. I also was the backup to my colleague who handles the interest rate swaps and equity derivatives and whatnot, which was similar to what I did in London, so that whenever he was on vacation, I would take over his role. And there, again, this was a so-called slow group, which means that at any given time, I have dozens and dozens of transactions to look at. And in order to do that, as opposed to, say, a transaction group which has like one transaction they were working on for six, nine, you know, months or whatnot, it was my job to handle a very broad range of responsibilities. We're leanly staffed here in the legal department in Wilton, so I had to leverage my time by relying on outside counsel. And I had outside counsel from each of the various areas dealing with the partners and the various associates. And depending upon the area, it could be fairly large number of people that work for the partner and also for, I guess, ultimately me.
Okay, so, you know, what we're interested in hearing about specifically are the contracts for the CDS written on the super senior tranches of the multi-sector CDOs. Were you involved in reviewing those contracts?
Yes, I was.
What was your role?
As an inside counsel, I was in charge of the team of lawyers that worked on the documentation for the various transactions. There are several roles that AIG FP played in these transactions. One as interest rate swap provider, and some of the trades we were 2A7 put counterparty, and some of the trades we were the credit default swap provider for whoever bought the bond. So the roles were varied. And the documentation also changed depending upon what the transaction, you know, role we played. I was the lawyer that interacted with the business people that worked on this in this area. Alan Frost and Adam Butnick were the two primary people here in Wilton. They were in charge of negotiating the business terms. The business terms meaning the fees, of course, the credit related, basically the structures, which are the reinvestment criteria, what the quality of the portfolio, what assets can go into the portfolio, what the attachment point was, and the collateral terms, such as the various provisions with respect to the changes to the definitions of exposure for purposes of posting of collateral. So once those business terms were negotiated with the counterparty, then that information is passed to me and to the outside counsel, and we would go about documenting them. There were a series, more than a handful of counterparties that we ended up doing the vast majority of our business here in Wilton. As an aside, a significant number of transactions were done out of London, but with respect to the Wilton trades, there's generally the first transaction with a bank would be heavily negotiated with respect to the documents, particularly at the very outset of when this business was started, to discuss the various terms. And then during that time, some back and forth as to what the documentation would look like. With respect to CDSs themselves, if you look at the conference themselves, generally they're the standard form CDS that the ISDA group promulgate, which is used in all sorts of contexts, with some modifications. And those modifications were the ones that were discussed with the other side to make sure that they get comfortable with it. And that's our job, was to, our, meaning mine and Alan, Adam, and also the others, and then our council, was to deal with the specific changes to the standard forms.
Okay, so let me ask you, in terms of the timing of while you're looking at these contracts, and these contracts, I mean the contracts on the CDS written on the super senior tranches of the multi-sector CDOs, are you looking at those and reviewing those from the time you get there in 99, or what's the timing of while you're reviewing these contracts?
I started looking at them in 03, so September 03, when I showed up in Wilton. I had no credit trades when I was in London.
Okay. And so, for example, you're looking, were there any counterparty contracts that you were not reviewing on the multi-sector book?
Yes. So like I said, a significant number of the trades were done out of London, so I couldn't tell you exactly what percentage, but the it's a minority. The majority were done out of Wilton, and these trades were, prior to 2003, September 2003, they were done by my predecessor, Mike Southwick. And then around the time, September, October, there was a transition between Mike and I. And then subsequent to that, the trades that were done in Wilton were primarily looked at by me or by our outside counsel.
Okay. And so these, so from the September 03 time period forward, you know, we've obviously received some documents from AIG, but, you know, we see that there's an IS, an ISDA master agreement, the credit support annex or CSA, and then what I believe are called confirms, you know, that follow that. Is that your understanding of essentially what the contracts entailed?
With respect to the CDSs, yes.
Okay. And, you know, so for example, were you looking at these types of, the paperwork constituting these contracts with counterparties like, you know, Goldman Sachs?
I would have to bifurcate my answer. With respect to master agreements, these master agreements tend to be with the banks. When they're with the banks, they are the general master agreements that govern the relationship of swap transactions between AIGFP and that bank generally. So in addition to the CDS, there'll be interest rate swaps, equity derivatives, things of that nature. For some of the banks, these master agreements were in place already, and so if, when you say look at, they were done by predecessors, or so, and some of them have dated, can be dated fairly, they're fairly old. With respect to a couple of them, I actually did as part of my ordinary course responsibilities when I, in particular when I was in London, putting in, because that was part of the so-called flow business or swaps, to put in these master agreements. So as it turns out, the is the master agreement governing the Goldman Sachs trade, the Goldman Sachs International is the master agreement I actually had worked on when I was in London initially with at Bank AIG of the counterparty, and subsequently cloned to AIGFP. So that's on the master side, master and schedule and CSA, that's all kind of grouped together. With respect to the transactions themselves, those are documented by confirms, and each confirm will put in place or document the specifics of that particular transaction. And for the these for each transaction specific documentation, I will be looking at for that relevant time period for most of them.
Okay. So after you review the is the master agreement between AIGFP and Goldman when you're in London, and I thought you said, and also the CSA. Is that true? Did I hear that correctly?
Yes. Okay. Yes, with respect to Goldman Sachs International, there are two.
Right, I understand there's a second Goldman Sachs entity, but
yeah,
I think
the market.
Right, but the majority of the deals are with GSI, right?
That's correct.
Okay. And so did the terms of the CSA change over time, or was there even a different CSA after the original ISDA master agreement and CSA are reviewed by you back in London?
The CSA itself is a framework which governs, like I said, the majority of the trade. Within the Israel architecture, parties are free to change what is the framework as they as may be required for specific transactions.
Mm-hmm.
So, in respect of the general structure of the CSA, to my knowledge, the CSA had not changed. But this is not an area that I would monitor day to day. With respect to a transaction itself, it was one of the main business points that Alan and Adam would negotiate with the counterparty when they set up a form CS form conference for the CDS to vary the definition of exposure in the CSA to account for two things. And this was important from, you know, from the business side, which is that exposure, which is generally done, generally calculated based upon the mark-to-market value of a swap transaction. Alan felt very, very strongly that the exposure should not reference the swap transaction for the CDO, to the senior CDO, because it was more, the prices for the reference obligation was more readily available at that time, so he wanted the exposure to be calculated with reference to the price of the reference obligation, which is a departure from the standard CSA provision. And the second thing he wanted was to build in the concept of a buffer, such that the price of the reference obligation may oscillate, so that but even though it oscillates, it doesn't then result in a collateral call on us. And the buffer he was able to negotiate varied from counterparty to counterparty.
Could you go over the first one again? This is Dixie Noonan. I'm sorry. I just want to make sure. Could you just go over that first one again?
Sure. Under if you happen to have a copy of the form, the printed form CSA, you will see that how this works is that exposures, which is a defined term, references is basically in order to calculate the exposure under a CSA, which then goes into the formula for how much collateral to be posted. The exposure references a mark-to-market of the transaction. If you kind of work through all the definitions and reference section 6 of the is the form itself. So if you go through all that, the standard exposure calculation would be you go and find what the mark-to-market is, the mark-to-market value of the transaction. So if you have an interest rate swap, you go and find out what the mark is of the interest rate swap, the value of the two legs, and that's what your transaction exposure is. For the CDS, you can do that also by trying to obtain the value from reference market makers of what a CDS on a particular reference obligation would be. The problem is that the thinking at that time was that since CDSs are illiquid, they're not like interest rate swaps, which are easily priced. A CDS is more hard to get a value for. However, at that time, and again, this is, seems like, you know, another world. At that time, super senior obligations of the CDOs, people were falling over themselves to try to buy. Everyone wanted them. So the price were primarily par or one or two basis points below par, so 99, 98. So the value of the bonds at that time was more readily available than the mark-to-market of the CDS transaction. So his view at that time was to not reference the, not to change the definition of exposure to equate two concepts. One is that the exposure will be calculated on the price of the reference obligation, which is the obligation that if there was a default on, we would have to make payments on for the CDS. And second, as I mentioned quickly, there's this buffer so that price can oscillate so before it actually obligates us to make a collateral payment.
And when you thank you. And when you talk in terms of the buffer, does that mean, because I've seen in other documents, for example, with Goldman, that even if there was, excuse me, if they said that there was a mark-to-market hit of $1 billion, that, you know, AIG didn't have to post until there was like a mark-to-market hit more than like $500 million. Is that what you meant?
No, I'm not sure what that refers to, but basically, if I may explain,
yes.
Goldman is a little odd, but most of the other ones, say SocGen or what have you, they have a grid. If you look at the specific collateral provisions, and there's an actual grid, which the one axis is the rating of the bond, and the other axis is the rating of AIG, the parent. So in the upper left-hand corner, there's two numbers. One is generally a number like 12%, and then there's a second number. The first number is the threshold, and the second number is an independent amount. So basically, the grid is that if the bond is rated AAA and AIG is rated AAA, there's a 12% threshold that the price of the bond may oscillate before AIG has to post a dollar. So, the exposure will be, because then you have to throw it into the big bucket of the CSA and then the other provisions of the CSA as to what the threshold is. But putting aside that, the exposure will be 12%, so the price of the bond has to go to below 88. So before there's $1 of exposure for that one trade. And the independent amount is basically kicks in. All right, so that's sort of the kind of, and then if you flip to the lower right hand corner, you'll see that the thresholds are zero, which means there's no buffer that the price can oscillate, and then there's an independent amount of some number, I forget those numbers. In other words, that we AIG would post more if you're in the lower right part of the grid. So that means that when AIG is rated BBB or whatnot, on the bound rate BBB, so you have more penalized. We're more penalized. So the negotiation that Alan and Adam, primarily Alan, did with respect to the grid was to get the counterparty to give up postings for $1 or whatnot if the situation is working out fine, which he really, really believed that AIG will be, you know, the bonds will be rated AAA and AIG will be rated AAA. So that we're always in that upper right, upper left-hand corner. In exchange for that, we agree to be penalized by having to post more when things don't work out as well, and when the ratings are poor for the bond, and ratings are poor for AIG. That's what that grid was. For Goldman, Goldman did not agree to have a buffer that was that was going to be a function of the rating of the underlying bond. Goldman only has a one line, if you will. It's not a grid, but just one, which would, so there's this buffer would vary with what AIG was rated. So that's, those are two differences.
Okay, but I understand that. And so the buffer was just related to either in one case the rating of the bond and the rating of AIG, or in Goldman's case just based on the rating of AIG.
Right.
Okay, but there was still, in the Goldman contracts and other contracts, you had to post collateral based on a decline in the market value of the underlying, of the reference bonds.
Right.
Okay, so let me ask you something. Were those terms, both the the collateral posting trigger based on a change in rating of the bond, a change in rating of AIG, and a change in the fair value of the reference bonds, always part of the contracts that you were looking at from the times you were in London all the way through to your times at Wilton, Connecticut?
Remember, in London, I didn't look at anything.
Well, you said you looked at the Goldman ISDA master agreement in the CSA.
Yes, but the ISDA master agreement didn't have those provisions.
Did the CSA?
The grid and the line, which I mentioned, were specific to CDSs on the super senior transactions. They were not part of the ISDA framework, because the ISDA framework presumed the standard structure for all swaps, interest rate swaps, equity, and whatnot. Those are not common to have a grid. for the CDSs specifically, Allen negotiated to have these extra provisions to alter the definition of exposure only for the CDS trades. And those were per transaction. And if you do sum total of all the positions, then you get a fairly large number given the volume that we worked on with Goldman.
So, I mean, but I get what you're saying, and thank you. But explain to me, since at least recently I haven't looked at the master agreement, the CSA, and the confirms, but does the CSA in itself include terms that say collateral is going to be posted if there's a decline in the value of the reference bonds or if there's a ratings downgrade of the bond or AIG, and then the confirms have the grid and the specifics to it? Is that how it works?
No, what happens is that the master agreement CSA form says exposure. That's the defined term. How you calculate exposure is there's a, unless you change it, is a standard methodology, which is the promulgate, which is the mark-to-market of the transaction. For the CDS on CDOs, Alan Frost negotiated that this particular exposure definition that's written in the form master agreement is overridden, and a new definition is put in place, and that's that equation above the grid.
And it's put in place, Jake, in the confirmation.
In the confirmation, I'm sorry. It's only in the confirmation. And you just kind of stepping back, the ISDA architecture is that you have the master agreement, you have the schedule, which can vary the form printed master agreement. You have the CSA form. You have the CSA schedule, which varies the form master agreement. And you have the confirm. Anything in the confirm can be used to override all those other bits, the master agreement, the schedule, the CSA, and the form.
Right, and I understand.
So what we did is to override the definition of exposure in the CSA. The definition of exposure in the CSA does not have the concept of a grid. The definition of the CSA does not have the concept of reference obligation. The definition of the CSA only looks at the whole swap transaction.
And I understand that. And assuming that none of this stuff was done, you know, that Mr. Budnick or Mr. Frost didn't make these changes that were reflected in the confirms, if I were to simply look at the master agreement, the schedule, the CSA, what I know from that AIG would have to post collateral if there was a decline in the fair value of the CDS, because that was a change that was made, as opposed to the reference obligations.
You would, yes.
Okay, so and then the confirm includes the grid and the changes to what's in the CSA and says we're changing the definition of exposures in the CSA, and now collateral is going to be required to be posted if there's either a change in the value of the reference obligations or if there's a downgrade in the rating of the bonds or of AIG.
That's correct.
Okay.
I just want to clarify, because earlier I thought you said that the mark-to-market collateral provision was contained in the standard confirm that AIGFP then altered for the super senior CDS. And
sorry, I might jump in. It's not the standard confirm, the standard form CSA.
Standard form CSA is where we would look to find this standard mark-to-market provision.
That's correct.
Thanks.
And were those types of mark-to-market standard provisions in the CSA, how were they standard back, you know, when you were looking at, for example, the ISDR Master Agreement and CSA in London?
Yes, these are the form itself. I think was promulgated in '95 or something of that nature. This is industry-wide is common.
Okay. Do you know if you know, one of the things, obviously, what one of the things that happened at AIG when we moved to the summer and fall of 2007. You know, Goldman makes the collateral call based on their belief that there has been a decline in the value of the reference obligations, and that, of course, leads to all the disputes and the collateral postings that AIGFP does make. We've heard from several executives that they didn't know about these terms in the contracts that required collateral to be posted based on a decline in the market value of the reference obligations. Was it your impression that folks at FP knew or didn't know about these terms? Obviously, other than Mr. Frost and Mr. Budnick, I take it those folks knew since they're the ones that you were working with.
I don't know whether other people knew about it. Other than I had one conversation with Alan Frost that he mentioned that Joe was aware of this. Joe Pisano was aware of it. Mm-hmm. And in our shop, as long as Joe is aware of it, then it tends to be okay.
Did Mr. Cassano ever tell you he was aware of it?
He did not.
Okay. When the collateral call, I'll tell you that the Goldman collateral call comes in on July 26, 2007, or thereabouts. I may have the exact date wrong. Did you ever hear anything in AIG like, what the heck? I didn't know about those terms from anybody?
No, I think we're more kind of, what the heck, why are they marking it this way, this low? Mm-hmm. That's more the, we understood that there was a collateral call. It's in our systems. It's all been fed into our systems. The surprise was what, at that level that they were marking it at.
When did Al Frost tell you that Cassano was aware of the collateral provisions?
It was early in the time we were doing the trades, when we were doing the forums. I couldn't give you an exact date, but it could be late 2003 when we were doing this.
So after you come to Wilton?
That's right.
But before the collateral calls come in?
Sorry?
But significantly before any collateral calls are actually made?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Just to be clear, I think Jake was just trying to say he did not really work on, he did not work in the CBS portfolio while he was in London. Only after September 03 would he have worked on these deals, and he didn't work with Al Frost before then either.
Right. The only exception I heard to that, and correct me if I'm wrong or misheard you, was that when you were in London, you at least looked at the Goldman ISDA master agreement and CSA.
I mean, he said he looked at the Goldman. International
Bank AIG. Yeah. Let me clarify.
Sure.
When I was in London, there was a number of trades that Bank AIG, which is the French bank that
right.
I work for, because AIG FP is only located in Wilton. Its subsidiary Bank AIG has offices in London and Paris. I was working in London. Bank AIG, as part of its ordinary course business, entered into swaps with Goldman Sachs International, so they had equity derivatives primarily, and because trades were done between Bank and Goldman Sachs International, I had to put an ISDA master agreement in place between those two entities to cover that type of trade. Now, because we were a small shop, once a particular form has been negotiated with a counterparty, we tend to duplicate that same form within our organization, subject to the sort of changes such as tax and whatnot, so that we don't have to reinvent the wheel. So that particular master agreement that was put into place when I was in London between Bank AIG and Goldman Sachs International was cloned by me, since I worked on the original one, to have AIG Financial Products.
Okay. So when Frost and Budnick negotiate the business terms and then forward them to you to review and I assume draft up into the confirm, is that a butchered fair description of what you said earlier?
Yes, generally, plus Cadwalader, like I said, I'm responsible for many areas, and Cadwalader helps with a lot of the sort of the actual work documentation process.
Okay, and so who else, if you know, is looking at these contracts once the deals are negotiated and papered?
I'm not sure what you say in terms of who else is looking at.
All right, let me ask you this. You get the deal terms from Budnick and Frost and you draft up the confirm. Is that how it works?
Well, stepping back, there's an approval process for every trade that's done here. The first step is to get credit approval after the transaction has been solidified in terms of the credit terms, in terms of the which is the attachment points, what the model is supposed to say, what exactly is the underlying collateral, what the various tranching is supposed to be, what is the actual underlying securities. All that is modeled. The results of the model is put and plus the description of the various portfolios for any particular CDO is then written up in a credit memo, which is sent to AIG for approval.
Mm-hmm.
Once that the headquarters approves it, then and this is again this is signed off by my boss, which is the Associate General Counsel, who looks at this. Plus, later on, also our credit people look at it, and then AIG's credit people actually have to approve it. And then once that's approved, then the terms, the business terms, are agreed. So people are aware of those. Then goes into the negotiation documentation section, and then those are dealt with by the lawyers, our side and their side. There's also a team of lawyers with respect to the transaction themselves. And then, so the CDS itself is between technically the purchaser of the bond and us. There's also the transaction team, which is working with the underwriter to actually form the CDO and the transaction documentation. So there's a fairly large team of people working on this thing. Once that's done, then there's internal systems that have to be upgraded. There's also a formal trade review process that's done here. So where the documentation is and the positions, which are computer inputs, are checked by a trade review group, which rotates. So this is a very, very involved process involving a lot of people. So I'm not really sure. I didn't really understand your question. But
sure. Let me try. I get it, and let me make sure I understood. Make sure we're talking about the same thing. I think we've seen, you know, some of these memos that go to the credit risk committee at AIG, and that we see, at least in the memos, is chaired by a guy named Kevin McGinn. Is that your understanding? That's who the memos go to?
Yes.
Okay. Now I don't see in those memos, and this is all I'm getting at is, you know, I'm trying to figure out how perhaps folks at AIG and perhaps AIGFP didn't know about these mark-to-market collateral posting terms in the contracts. And while I certainly see a lot of information in these memos that go to the Credit Risk Committee about, you know, attachment points and the underlying collateral and all that, I don't see in those memos, you know, an actual draft of the contract or any disclosure that there are these mark-to-market collateral posting terms in the contracts. Is that your understanding too?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, and that's all I was getting at. So, and that's why what I'm trying to understand is, given that fact, you know, who else, if you know, actually sees the contracts, you know, once they're done, or even while they're being negotiated, such that they would at least have constructive knowledge, you know, of those mark-to-market collateral posting terms.
You mean, well, besides the lawyers, besides Budnick and Frost, yeah, do you know of anyone else at NC or AIG who have actually seen the physical contract, either in draft or final?
Yeah, thank you.
before a transaction is done, I don't think anybody.
Okay, what about after the... Right.
Afterwards, every contract is reviewed through what we call trade review. It's also, every contract is then scanned into our electronic filing cabinet, and then the reports are populated with the information with respect to these transactions, so that people monitor what these requirements are. Because of the fact that they will go under most of these will go under a general, is the master agreement with the counterparty, the collateral group needs to know what the positions are that will require collateral, because the other side will send a collateral call listing all what they believe the marks are of the various positions, so which will include these CDSs. And then we would go and look at we have our own. So if there's a dispute over the overall number, they can go and look at which are the transactions that cause discrepancy. And so that's all part of our system. So every trade that has a collateral requirement, which includes the CDS, will be entered into the system so they will know what to do. And that's what happened when there was a problem with Goldman, that they had a very out-of-whack collateral call. They were able to, our collateral group can be able to pinpoint exactly what they get the data from the other side, from Goldman, as to what their numbers, their mark-to-markets, or whatever exposure calculations were, and we can see against our system-generated ones, and we can see which were the outliers, and that's how we knew.
You mentioned that when Goldman came in with their collateral call, they were out of whack. Why were they out of whack?
They had, again, this is based upon our system, what our system was generating. Our system had a certain output as to what the exposure was for that particular for the various trades, and it was nowhere near the number that Goldman was asking for, and that because of the size, it was our collateral people elevated very quickly to the key business people, and so the business people's job was to negotiate with Goldman to kind of find out what's going on, and that led to this further discussion.
How did AIG or FP or whatever entity it was come up with its marks?
I don't know. I'm a lawyer.
Yeah.
It's all systems and modeling. So I really don't know.
I sympathize, by the way.
With the marks that the collateral group generates through the systems, would that have included not just the CDS marks, but that would have been a net total of all the positions with the counterparty?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
So this collateral group that you mentioned, you know, when the contracts are done and entered into the system, who's part of the collateral group?
The former head was a person called Joe Rooney, and then he has a team of maybe a dozen people. It's their job. They have daily collateral calls with all our counterparties. We have several hundred master agreements, and say the vast majority of them have CFAs. So it's an operations group. They daily get calls. We also make calls, because we make a lot of calls depending upon what the particular positions are. So it is their job on a daily basis to interact with the counterpart collateral group on the other banks, and they will be posting both directions.
So are they coming up with marks on a daily basis?
Yeah, the system generates that.
Okay.
They don't calculate. It's all machine calculated.
All right, and based on what gets calculated, that determines the collateral flow.
That's right. The collateral call on them and their call on us, and whether we agree or not.
Do you have an understanding as to who's giving the system inputs, whether that's traders or someone else at AIG?
Sorry, I don't know.
Okay, what was your involvement, if any, once the Goldman collateral call came in?
This was a discussion that was bumped up to the business people. I was not involved in the discussions themselves.
Okay. So the out of whack comment earlier, just based on stuff you heard from the business people?
Right.
Okay. Bear with me a minute. Go ahead.
Do you know, we have seen documentation that the thresholds in the Goldman contracts were considerably lower than the other counterparties. Specifically, we heard that, we've seen actual documentation that suggests that the Goldman thresholds were generally either 4% or in some instances could be zero upon a downgrade of AIG, whereas the sort of more typical threshold was 8% for the counterparties. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I think as a general matter, we had wanted to push it as high as we could, and that was subject of negotiation. Our form went out with a threshold of 12%. Goldman, there's a lot more kind of negotiation back and forth as to what the buffer should look like, and it was ended up being what it was. It's like, I think it was 8 or 6 or something of that nature. But please keep in mind, this is, in some ways, it's sort of irrelevant because it presumes a price that does not go below, let's say, 88, if we were able to even get our way. The prices of these bonds collapsed to, you know, 50 or below on a good number of them. So the percentages are very small as to what would have been any value to us.
Okay.
And the whole point was that the thinking was that these buffers would meant to obviate the entire need to actually post collateral, because at that time it was the business people's view that given the market for the reference obligations and whatnot, it was not likely at all that we would ever have to post, because the pricing was only like 1 or 2 basis points. 12 was like just more than you need, the universe practically. But unfortunately, the world changed significantly, and pricing went down much more than what was anticipated back then.
And so when you talk about, you know, that the standard form had a 12% buffer, and
in the very upper left-hand corner, yeah.
Right, and just, I'm just struggling to make sure I understand this correctly. Does that mean then, for example, that in terms of a mark-to-market valuation decline, that AIG would not have to post collateral unless the market value of the reference obligation didn't decline by at least 12%?
Not 12%, 12 basis points.
Oh, 12 basis points, I'm sorry.
Oh. Yeah, so 88, a price of 88 as opposed to par.
Well,
like 87.
Well, that's, well, wait a minute, but that's different. I mean, that is 12%, that's not 12 basis points. I mean, 100 basis points
right.
is 1%.
Yeah, you're right, sorry. That's why I'm not a math. Let me just look at one of these, just so I don't mistake.
So, and you know, maybe it helps to work in sort of an example of theoretical example. Like if the underlying reference bond that was $1,000, you know, if the market value would have to decline to what, $880? I mean, $880 before, you know, AIG right. would have to post.
No, if you look at the equation, basically pricing is done by percentage. So a par bond is 100%.
Right.
So it has to, if you look at the equation, exposure equals OPB times, forget the max of zero, that basically can't go less than zero. Basically 100% minus the market value, so the quotation is based on a percentage. So if the price was 88%, then you subtract the 12. So 100 minus 88 is 12,
right.
minus 12, say we're up there, and then your independent amount is zero, that means that the exposure is zero. That's one example. So,
but if the price were 87, then the exposure
right,
would be 1.
If the price was 87, exactly. If 100 minus 87 and then is 13 minus 12, then you got 1%, right? 1% times the
the deal size.
Times the deal size. That's correct. So it is percent.
Okay, I get it. I think.
Okay, thank you.
I think I get it now. And so it's your understanding that, you know, I know the standard form was 12%, but your recollection is that Goldman negotiated that down to ballpark 6 to 8%?
Yeah, something of that nature.
Okay.
Later on, at some point in, let me preface that. I think you were involved in negotiating the side letters that AIG and Goldman executed that just sort of codified that they were in dispute?
Yes.
Is that accurate? Okay.
Well, I didn't negotiate that. Basically, the terms were negotiated. I received the draft, and we just cleaned up the language.
I'm sorry. Yeah, you were involved in the process of executing a letter which suggested that whatever collateral was posted was not considered dispositive by either side.
Right, exactly. The agreement to disagree. Basically, I was told what the agreement was between the parties, and they had served up a draft, and we tinkered with the language to make sure that we preserved any rights that we had.
At some point in 2008, we came across a series of emails indicating that AIG wanted to add a sentence in its side letters suggesting that it was posting more collateral because it was looking at third-party marks. Do you have a recollection of that?
I don't.
Do you have any recollection of discussion as to whether or not third-party marks were a valid consideration for the collateral disputes?
I heard secondhand that there was a lot of discussions about their pricing methodology, and I know there are some alternatives that we had offered up, but I was not part of those discussions.
You said you were not part of those discussions?
I was not part of the discussions, no.
Mr. Sun, did you ever look at any monoline CDS contracts? The reason I ask is because it's my understanding that those contracts did not contain provisions that required the monolines to post collateral, I think, upon any, for any reason.
Right. I have not looked at one, but I am generally aware that monolines do not post collateral. I understand that in order for us to enter into this business, it was a business decision that we had to post collateral, otherwise we couldn't either do the business or couldn't do the volumes that people wanted to do.
Do you know who gave you that impression?
Al Frost.
And do you know what he based that on?
No, don't know.
Let me ask you, this may be related to that. You know, one of the things we've noticed that is the multi-sector book triples in size during 2005. It was about $17 billion at the end of 2004 and was like $54 billion at the end of 2005. Did FP, make any changes to either threshold amounts or anything else in the contract to up the volume of that business, do you know?
No, not that I'm aware of. I know that we became the party of choice because we were known and we sort of pride ourselves in execution. So that so long as the transactions met our strict criteria, then we would do our best to get this done. So people sort of knew what, because we sent out the form with just a new counterparty, and people, if they get comfortable with the form, then we tend to use the same form CDS over and over again with minor changes on the document side. And we were very efficient with our law firms, and we didn't basically negotiate just for the sake of negotiation. So I don't know. Their reputation was that we would get deals done, and we seem to have done that.
Did FP, while you were there, to your knowledge, write these multi-sector CDO contracts ever without collateral posting provisions?
I would have to look at. I don't know off the top of my head. I don't know of any of the transactions over in London, and I think there were a handful of transactions which were more unusual that didn't have collateral posting requirements.
Is it multi-sector CDSs?
Again, this is back in the days when we were analyzing the book. I vaguely remember that there were a few that didn't have. Some of them were out of London. But there were not that many, if there were.
I'm sorry, did you say that there were some in the multi-sector book, or no?
I believe there were some. I think some of them came out of our London office. I don't, off the top of my head, recall whether there were any in Wilton.
So, and again, you know, when you heard from Frost that, you know, the collateral posting terms were necessary to either do the business or do the business in volume, that doesn't jog any memory bells about, excuse me, about not having those provisions in the contracts previously?
No, I don't really understand the question.
I'm just really trying to probe further into your statement earlier that it was a business decision to include these collateral posting provisions in the contracts because Frost told you otherwise AIG couldn't do the business or couldn't do the business in the volumes that it wanted to. One is, again, is that a fair characterization of what you said?
Yes.
Okay. And given that, that doesn't jog any memory bells about whether or not at some time before then AIG was doing the business, but perhaps not in as large of volumes, without those kind of terms.
No, there were none that I was aware of with respect to any volume. If there's one or two trades here and there, that might possibly be the case, but I, as I said, I don't know of them off the top of my head.
Okay.
It wasn't a sequential thing where at one point they didn't have them and all of a sudden to ramp
right.
up.
Right, no. It was because of some unique feature of a particular deal that made it didn't fall within the normal circumstance, and the normal circumstance was to have a collateralization.
Okay.
So I think we asked this indirectly before, but I just wanted to specifically ask, are you ever aware of Joe Cassano specifically reviewing any contracts and or signing off on them?
I'm not aware of any.
And same question for anyone at AIG, the parent company.
The actual conference itself?
Yes.
I'm not aware of any.
And there was no requirement within the FP operations that that happen?
That's correct.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Sun, I think that's all we got. Thank you very much for your time. As I'll tell you what I tell everyone, I mean, we'll go back and look at our notes, and we probably figure out we forgot to ask you something, and if so, we'll contact your lawyers, but hopefully that won't be the case, and we won't have to bother you again. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye, guys.
Bye, thanks, Chris. Thanks, Stacey.
Thank
See you, guys.
Bye, Rob.
Goodbye.
Bye.